originating from our Jimmy John's of Lexington studios. This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
But it was all for Chuck McGee. Super Sabre wins the Derby for Todd Fletcher.
Basalt will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And Dialed In never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Now here's Jude Feld.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Trainer Talk. Tonight's broadcast, sponsored by Fasig Tipton, is the show that trainers listen to. This is Jude Feld, and I'm absolutely delighted to spend the next hour with you and our special guest. Tonight's trainer comes from a racing family. He's a graduate of the University of Louisville Equine Business Program, and he spent a lot of time learning his craft from outstanding trainers such as Wesley Ward, Nick Zito, Larry Jones, and Joe Sharp. He broke his maiden at Keeneland on opening day of last fall's meeting, and if his opening weekend at Oaklawn Park is any indication, there are many more Winner's Circle photos in his future. Welcome to Trainer Talk, Jason Barkley. What's up,
hey,
Jason?
Hey, dude, how are you?
Good.
Just wrapping up the morning here down at Oaklawn. It's a little cold down here today.
But, yeah.
We made it through the morning.
Well, that's good. You chose to go to Oaklawn, I read, because of the good purses and the outstanding races. How's that working out for you?
Well, so far so good. We had a really good opening weekend. Had a filly that I claimed for 15 off at Churchill that we ran down here for 30, and she ran second, got beat ahead, 20-1. And then a gelding I claimed from Turfway with the race in mind down here on the bottom. I claimed him for a nickel. We ran him for 62.50. And, he ran third, only got beat a few lengths, and he was, 38-1. So it's kind of playing out how I planned. We came down here fit, and, we're set up for the next go-around of their races. So, everybody so far is pretty happy with where we're at, and I am as well.
Yeah, that's good. When you bring fit horses into Oaklawn, you've got a little bit of an edge because the weather is usually pretty lousy December, January time, and a lot of those horses that are there year-round, they don't get the training in them that horses coming from other locations have.
Yeah, you get down here, and it's hit or miss with the training. I got here, we had about four good days. And then 3 days where we couldn't train, and got a couple more, and you just kind of got to pick your spots and stay as sound as you can. And if the track's not to your liking, try to stay off of it, and do what you can in the shed row. And if you don't want to do that, just walk them and keep them happy, and that's kind of what I did for the most part. We trained the horses at all ran this past weekend. They only trained 3 days before they raced after having a couple days off. And, it kind of goes a long way. You keep the horses happy and healthy, and they're happy, and they'll perform for you.
Yeah, that's right. Sometimes you have to adjust on the fly. You might have a work planned or something. They close the track. You can't get too anxious. You just got to take a deep breath and go from there. What sparked your interest in thoroughbred racing? How did you get in the game?
I grew up around it. My dad, he's been in the business, since as long as I can remember. And then my grandfather on my mother's side was a trainer. My dad actually worked for him. And then my dad's dad, he was he owned horses, and he trained a few on his own as well. And then my great-grandmother and great-grandfather, they also were in the business. So I've just been around it forever, and, growing up, I knew I wanted to be in it somehow. When I was little, I was small enough, I was like, oh, maybe I'll be a jockey. But I was never really around anybody that rode, so I was like, I'll just keep my feet on the ground. And I kind of like it that way because I can see everything that's going on with all the horses rather than just the one I'm on. And so I've just been doing it since I was little and just kind of went up through the process of, all right, here I am. Let's take the next step. Went to U of L. equine program, and you know, that was a great experience. I met so many people in that program. You know, the late Tim Capps, he was very influential in who I got to meet and be around, and you know, he would introduce you to anybody and everybody and put you in the right spots. And then, you know, from there I went on and worked for, you know, some great trainers, and here we are today. So you know, just I love the action. You know, I love the grind of it and the action that goes with it. And then you, unlike a lot of businesses, you know, you can do well enough to, like, get by, but you can really see the results in what you do in horse racing, because it plays out for you every, you know, 3 or 4 weeks.
Well, you, three generations of your family in the business, that's very noteworthy. And hanging around your dad's barn, you probably picked up a lot of stuff, and your grandfather's barn too, huh?
Yeah, you know, it's funny, because, you know, I've got my shelf in my office with all of my different liniments and things that I use, and a lot of it are, you know, kind of older school things that my dad and grandfather use, and things that Larry does, and I kind of pulled those in with, you know, kind of the new age stuff as well, and you kind of put it all together, and it really works for you if you're willing to put in the time, and because a lot of things, you know, that they did back in the day was, you know, a lot of, you know, rubbing the legs, you know, making sure everything was, you know, tip top shape, and that's kind of what I do. You know, I have to make sure that I pull that in, because, you know, I really appreciate, you know, that level of care and that goes into it. But then at the same time, you know, you have all these new age things that you can do with, you know, the, like, chiropractic or things that weren't getting done then, that you can kind of bring it out to chiropractors, different, you know, machines like the MagnaWave, and, you know, different things that you can, you know, lay over the top of it. And you put it all together, and it kind of really, you know, is a unique thing that I feel like I can bring to the table.
Yeah, it's nice to have that combination, isn't it? For, like, the modern day devices and things that people use to enhance a horse's progress and health, and then those old school things that people don't even, a lot of people don't even remember them. I remember doing a Derby broadcast with Tom Leach, and Jack Vanberg brought a horse into the walking ring at Churchill Downs, and you could smell the absorbine coming off of him. And I go, oh, I love that smell. And you know, Leach says to me, what is it? I said, it's absorbine. I said, it's really old school. You don't smell it very much. Trainers don't put absorbine on their horses in a blanket before they go over. But I said, you know, it's nice. The horse gets a little rub down, and they get to feeling good, and that warms their muscles up. And I said, it's really old school. So we talked about it on the radio. Leach goes, I've never heard of that. That's great. Let's use it on the radio. So we did. And some of those things, they really can help a horse. And a lot of people these days don't do it.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of, you have a lot of guys, once they get bigger, it's hard to give that individual attention to, like, every horse. And so it becomes more of a system of just, you know, well, this is what, you know, this is what we're going to do, and, you know, it's going to work. And if it doesn't work, you know, we'll adjust on the fly if we think we can help them another way. So you kind of, you fall into a rut where, you know, you have so many things going and working in the bigger barns, you can kind of see it. But as an assistant, it's kind of your job to, you know, go make sure all the little things are getting done so that, you know, your boss, your trainer can do all the, you know, the hire and making all the big decisions. And so, you know, when I was an assistant for guys, I would try to bring in the things that I knew to try to help them. Like when I worked for Joe, I was in Florida at Gulfstream with 30 head, you know, when we got there. And, you know, he kind of handled the entries and where we were going to run and all that. But, you know, everything else kind of left, you know, up to me. And then he and I would talk about it, and I would just kind of put a plan, and we would juggle it and go from there. And, you know, so that kind of got me to where I was like, all right, I can handle, you know, a big string. I can handle 30, 40 head of horses at a time. And that's, you know, where I'm trying to get to it now. And you just grow from there. You know, having what I have right now with the five that I have at Oakland, I can have my hands on everything without, you know, having to worry about missing the big stuff, because you know, I have, you know, that's, you know, it's my job and it's also my hobby. So I don't mind spending a whole day at the barn to, you know, make sure everything's in place. And, you know, I'll sit around in the afternoon, you know, make sure I have a plan for every horse, where they're going to run, you know, when they're going to work. You know, I don't have to do that in the morning for 50 horses because that'll take all day. I've just got the 5 right now, so I can kind of make it. It just, you know, it kind of works for me.
Yeah, I read as I was doing research about you for the show, I read when you first started out, you had 4 horses that you were rubbing yourself. And there's something about that when you're that close to a horse every day that really can make a difference with a young trainer. You know, I think that's one of the advantages that young guys have over some of the trainers that have been around a long time, is that they're underneath those horses. They're enthusiastic about them, and every day they're putting their hands on them. Whereas even somebody that has 20, 30 head of horses, which isn't a lot in today's day and age, but it's still quite a few horses, they can't have that intimate relationship with the horse that a young trainer can, that only has a few horses.
Yeah, you know, like right now, I said, like, I have the 5 year, and it's just me and my exercise rider, and, you know, he and I kind of do everything, and I rub them all myself, and I get there early, and I leave late, and that's great for me, and I get to see everything, and if something changes, you know, from day to day, I'm on top of it. Whereas, you know, like you said, you know, you get in those barns and more horses, you know, you're kind of reliant on your grooms, and, you know, they might miss something, and then in turn, you might miss it. So, you know, you just got to try to stay on the ball, and being small, you can do that. And, you know, my goal is, as I grow, to still be able to be that, you know, on top of things and in there working on it. And, you know, I have no problem getting in there even when I was an assistant, and, like, you know, for a bigger barn, you know, if there was an issue with a foot that needed to be taken care of specifically, I would jump in and do it, make sure it got done the right way.
Yeah, there's no escaping, you know, that if you do it yourself, you know it's done the way that you want it. And sometimes you have to delegate, but it's always good at least to be there to supervise. You went to U of L. You went through the Equine Business Program, which is a fantastic program, and we work together with them on sponsorship and stuff. They're a great organization. But you were studying business and stuff. When did you decide that you really wanted to train horses more than anything?
You know, I went, it's funny. It was like, I went, when I was in high school as a senior, I had applied to U of L, like summer going into senior year, and I got accepted by September. And had I not got in, I don't know that I would have venture off and went to college anymore. I would have just dove in and, you know, worked for somebody. I worked for Larry and gone from there. You know, I worked for my dad and then decided to train. And, you know, so I kind of knew out of high school I wanted to train, but I knew I needed to get out and meet more people. Because growing up in Evansville and being at Ellis Park my whole life, you only know those people. And about the time I was in high school, it was kind of when they were on their little, you know, it was kind of sliding the wrong way at Ellis. So you didn't have the big barns coming in all the time, and you didn't get to see the, you know, people that you needed to meet and know in this business. Because it's, you know, it's not just what you know, but it's also a little bit of who you know, because you got to be put in the right position and get the right horses to succeed on top of everything else you do. So I'd say, like, you know, when I was in high school, I knew I wanted to train. But I knew I needed to get out and learn a little more and meet some more people. And, you know, going to U of L and meeting everybody and really kind of drove it home that, you know, I wanted to train. And being around Churchill all the time and, you know, going to the derbies while I was in school. And, you know, I did a little side work for TVG while I was in college during the Breeders' Cup. So getting to be around all those big horses was kind of, you know, like, all right, this is definitely it. Like, you see all these, you know, big trainers, big horses, and you're like, no, I know enough to be able to get to that level at some point. So now how can I make it happen? And, you know, the first step, I got out of school, went and worked for Nick Zito, you know, classic trainer, derby winner, trainer, just a great, great guy. you know, I still talk to Nick when I see him all the time, you know, at Keeneland and Churchill and wherever it might turn up. And, you know, I learned a lot in that barn, for sure, you know, right out of college, because we had about 80 horses at Saratoga. So, you know, you get thrown into that and you kind of see, you know, with five horses, you walk in and maybe once every few weeks, you have a big hang up. You have a barn of 80. Every day you have something. Like, you might have a sick horse, you might have this, you might have that. So you kind of brings you, you know, brings it all full circle where you have, you're always juggling, you know, the races and all the things that you have to do, and then all your little issues that you have to make sure get managed as well.
Yeah, there's so many facets to it, and it helps working for a big barn. You know, you mentioned relationships and how important they are, and our business is based on relationships. That's how you get clients. That's how you develop a rapport with racing secretaries and all of that stuff. And so it's a good thing that you took that approach. The other thing too is you have that great business background, and oftentimes when young trainers come to me and ask me for advice, that they say, you know, what do I do? How am I supposed to go about this? And I say, you got to pay attention to the business part of it as much as you do the horses. And sometimes that's hard for a young guy because they're doing what you're doing, rubbing their own horses. They're really paying attention to the horses, and sometimes the business part goes on the slide. But it's so important if you're going to stay in business and operate on a high level that you have that business savvy, or at least, you know, find somebody that does that can be on your team. And you're very fortunate that you have both sides of the coin.
Yeah, you know, like, it was very beneficial for me because, you know, at U of L, not only was it just equine business, it was also, you know, you took all the regular business courses. And it's kind of, you know, when I was in college, it was kind of when Twitter was taking, you know, kind of taking its place in social media. And you could see trainers that started to, like, have, you know, like, pictures of their horses or updates of their horses. And I do my best. You know, when I have horses in for the weekend, you know, I'll post something, you know, and let everybody know what's going on. Or if I have a breed, I'll try to post it on Twitter. And I try to stay active out there so, you know, people see your name and, you know, they, you know, can kind of, oh, well, who is this guy? You know, his horse ran second at 20-1, just got beat off the claim. Maybe we should dig a little deeper. And if it hits home with one person, then, and they decide, hey, I need a new trainer, you know, maybe I should give this guy a call. And, you know, I met Brian DiDonato from TDN. He and I, you know, we kind of started up a little syndicate. We bought some babies, and we met through Twitter. And that's how it all started talking. And we went to the Keeneland sale together, and we bought a filly by the factor with the game plan of getting her ready to run in April. And that's, you know, for Franklin Ave Equine. And, you know, we sold chairs. We kind of did it that way. But having that business background to know, you know, what you need to do and how you need to set that up to make it a feasible option kind of all came into play as well. You know, because we talk about, all right, how are we going to sell the shares? How do we want to make this easy on the people that come into it? So instead of just buying your share and getting a monthly bill, because that's no fun on a baby that's not going to run for 8 months, and we set it up that you buy in, and then you're in, you know, you pay a little more to get in, but you don't get a bill until June. And our plan is for this horse to run by April or May. So if they run early and they do well enough, these people that bought in may never see a bill. You know, because you don't want to bring people in and then just start charging them every month for a horse that they, one, probably haven't seen, two, hasn't raced, three, isn't even up to a work yet. Because then, you know, that's no way to build a customer base. So, you know, it's kind of a different approach where you see a lot of the bigger syndicates, you buy in, get built quarterly, and the horse is going to run in 6 months, and you hope for the best. You know, so it's just a lot of trying to bring all the different business things that I've learned, you know, into what I do. But, you know, I do a lot of social media. My owners get an email every week with the update of how their horse is doing, you know, I talk to them throughout the week, but, you know, if they might have a partner, they can forward it on. And it's just, you know, a picture, a video, hey, this is where I want to run. You know, what do you think? You know, I try to have a good rapport back and forth with them. And it goes, you know, it goes pretty well.
Yeah, communication is very important with clients. It's really number one. You've got to be accessible, and you've got to have those discussions. And sometimes you have to educate them. You know, it's like this show. The purpose of this show is to put a face with the name in the program. So when somebody listens to the show and they hear you talking, and then they're looking in the form and they see Jason Barkley, they know, oh, I know about that guy. He's, you know, he's young. He's trying to make it big in our game, and you know, so they pay attention to you. They watch you, and that's that, you know, that's part of the whole thing is education for the fans, and as well as entertainment. You know, you were talking about Twitter. Kenny McPeak did something a while back that I thought was really cool. He had a big horse, and I can't remember who the horse was, but was getting ready for a race and grabbed the quarter, right? So a lot of people hear horses grab quarters, but they didn't know what it was. But Kenny took a picture of the grab quarter, explained a little bit, and then followed it up like every few days with a new picture and how the horse was healing and what they were doing for it. I thought it was like one of the coolest things ever to educate, you know, fans and horse players about what a grab quarter was. And things like that are invaluable, I think, for the people that are involved in our sport that aren't on the racetrack on a daily basis and don't have any idea what some of these things that horses get, you know, and what's involved in taking care of a horse that has an injury, what's involved with that. So I thought that was pretty clever.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, anytime you can educate your clients or the fans or anybody, you know, you're doing something right. And but speaking of grabbed quarters, like the filly that I had that won at Keeneland, I ran her back at Churchill, you know, 5 weeks later, and she goes off 3-2 favorite, and she grabs a quarter. She actually grabbed it twice, grabbed the inside and the outside. And so she gets claimed that day. Well, it looks bad because she ran bad at 3-2. And you know, I was like, you know, I wish I would have thought of something along those lines to kind of explain it, because, you know, it just looks those. Well, you know, she didn't perform like she did last time. Like, you know, what went wrong, blah, 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 blah. There's nothing you can really, you know, at the time I was like, well, you know, she got claimed, so just move on. And, you know, she actually came back, and the guy that claimed her, she won at Laurel. And I was happy to see her win because, you know, she's a hard knocker. I think she's like 7-for-11 lifetime now or something like that. She's a... So, you know, anytime you can take time to educate is always a good thing. I always tell my owners, you know, bring your friends by the barn and come out yourself happy to, you know, teach you. Because my biggest owner, Oakview Stable and Tommy Todd, you know, he's only been in the business for about a year and a half now. And, you know, my first win was also his first win. So that was pretty cool. And, you know, he comes out anytime he can. And we talk. I talk to him probably every day about, you know, how the horses are doing. Hey, what do you think about maybe claiming this horse? Or, you know, let's watch this one a couple of times and see where we're at, you know, at the end of the Oaklawn meet. You know, I've started to compile a list since I got down here of horses that I'm kind of keeping an eye on to kind of claim and maybe run once here and then take them back to Kentucky. And so I always am trying to educate him to make sure that he knows what's going on. And, you know, so far so good.
Yeah, that's cool. If you joined us a little late, this is Trainer Talk, and we're talking with Trainer Jeff Barkley on the Horse Racing Radio Network. You mentioned keeping a list of horses and future claims. You know, do you go check legs every day? The setup at Oaklawn is different than a lot of racetracks with the indoor paddock and stuff. But do you spend some time at the races looking at horses' legs and stuff and seeing who you could help, who you couldn't help, and that kind of thing?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, opening weekend was kind of difficult for me because I ran one every day, so I didn't make it over there much. I was there some at the end of the day Sunday. I watched a few that I liked, and then Monday, you know, because we ran because of the holiday, I spent, you know, I was over there all day. I had about four horses that I wanted to look at, and a couple of them I crossed off, and a couple I stayed on the list. and they ran well, and I'll probably watch them, you know, if they run them. They were a little out of my price range, or, you know, more along lines of I didn't think they were worth what they were in for. And so if they were to drop in, you know, there'll be horses that I'll kind of, you know, take a shot at probably next time or the time after that. And it's just about, you know, paying attention to everything and getting, getting a feel for the horse. Because, you know, you can only find so much in the form and on replays and all that. And, you know, I try to bring it all full circle with, you know, I start in the form and I go to the race replays and I use thoroughbred numbers as well. And then from there it becomes a physical. Okay, what do I like them the day I see them when they're in? And, you know, I try to bring everything in. You can't just, you know, go from a little bit to another. You can't just go from, you know, only looking at the form and saying, yes, I want that horse, because he may have something that you can't handle and you don't know how to deal with it, or, you know, he may not have as many bullets left to fire as you want. You need him to have.
Yeah, and especially, you know, when you're looking towards another meet, a lot of people don't realize you have to claim a horse late in the meet, or otherwise you can't take him anywhere. Most states are very protective about their horse population, and if you claim a horse at Oaklawn, you're not allowed to take him out of state and run him someplace else. So you have to have the timing factor involved too. It's all very fascinating. I've got a lot more questions to ask you about claiming horses. I know that's part of your strength and one of the things that you enjoy to do, but we'll have to get to that after the first break, because it's time for us to pay for the show and then we'll come back and join you for the next half hour. You're listening to Trainer Talk on Horse Racing Radio Network, and we'll be back with Jason Barkley right after these words.
Make plans now to attend the Fasig Tipton Kentucky Winter Mix Sale February 5th and 6th at the Fasig Tipton Sales Grounds on Newtown Pike in Lexington, Kentucky. And nominations are now being accepted for the 2018 Fasig Tipton Gulfstream Sale, being held at Gulfstream Park in Hallandale Beach, Florida on March 28th. You can nominate to this premier two-year-old in training sale by visiting FasigTipton.com. That's FasigTipton.com. Where will you be?
Bloom Racing.
Majestic City could also still do it, and here he comes.
Majestic City running a big one.
Started by former jockey and 35-year racing industry veteran Jeffrey Bloom, Bloom Racing offers racing partnerships, bloodstock services, pin hooking, and private race management.
Soul Driver the leader, though. Soul Driver in front.
Experience the fun, excitement, and exclusive access of racehorse ownership with Bloom Racing. Forming racing partnerships now. Get in on the action at bloomracing.com.
It all started with a dream. A dream to be the best. To breed the best. To race the best.
Super Saver Rossemeyer, what a finish to the class.
And to stand the best. Windstar Farm. Dedicated to the dream.
This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Enchanted Fact short lead. Stella Nova's second by two and tries to draw alongside the leader, Raze. Your L up to the far outside is in third. And Noy, his fourth back toward the inside. Hot Yankee still six lengths off the lead with Street Cruiser down toward the inside. And in the meantime, Stella Nova narrow lead. And Noy moves up in second in between horses. Past the eighth pole, Enchanted Facts fighting on, but now third toward the rail. Stella Nova with the lead. Stella Nova past the 16th pole has the advantage by three. Late run from Dustin Carolina from far back. Stella Nova wins it, though, for Paco Lopez. Annoy home second. Dustin Carolina up third, and a multiple horse photo for fourth.
Welcome back to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. This is Jude Feld with our special guest, trainer Jason Barkley. I want to remind you that if you missed any portion of this show, it will be archived on our website, horseracingradio.net, and it is also available at Horse Racing Radio on iTunes. How'd that sound, Jason?
That's my favorite race
call. Yeah.
I could probably do it word for word.
Kurt Becker is probably flattered. Yeah, that was quite exciting. I read that you had planned on winning your first race at Keeneland. Is that true?
Yeah, it is actually. My plan forever is, all right, you know, it kind of goes back into the business side of things. Where can you make a splash where most people are going to see you? And I went out on my own in May and I ran a few at Ellis. And, you know, you want to win, obviously. But I was like, you know, just run well and let's just keep going forward here. And, you know, I didn't really have the success I wanted to have at Ellis, but I only ran, I think, 3 at the meet. So it wasn't that big of a deal. But forever, I was like, you know, you win at Keeneland, people are going to see that. And it was just perfect how it worked out. You know, I got the race I wanted. It was opening day. I got Paco on a pure speed horse. Which, you know, I got the Paco look around at the top of the lane, and I was like, just ride, Paco, just please just ride. Because, I mean, that's the great thing about Paco. At the quarter pole, you think you got a shot no matter what, because he's looking for competition. And, but he rode a great race. You know, he rode the horse outside of him, then he came back in, he rode 3 horses in the lane. You know, he rode that horse out.
Angel Cordero
he
style.
He rode Annoy and, you know, kind of shut her off a little. And then, you know, when he reached back and cracked her, she found another gear. But, yeah, the plan forever was, you know, let's win at Keeneland. And my best friend, I told him, because he, you know, he has his business. And he's like, you got to make a splash. And, you know, it worked perfect. Opening day at Keeneland, my phone vibrated from the time I left the winner's circle to the time I got to the test barn. And, it couldn't work out any better.
Yeah, it said the article said you had a lot of your friends out there, and they were all cheering, and that must have been quite a deal. That's fantastic.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they were scattered throughout the winners or the paddock and the, you know, the by the paddock bar, and I get to the winner's circle, you know, and I think I might have blacked out when she hit the wire because I don't really remember it, but I look around and they're all in the winner's circle, so you know it was good to kind of have everybody there that you know has kind of been a part of my life for a while, and I know my parents watched it at home, and I'd have loved to have had a camera in that house. So I know, because my dad, he doesn't really get excited. And my mom said when they hit the top of the lane, he was probably riding harder than Paco was. So it was just a great day. And I was happy for it to happen at Keeneland. And, you know, I was happy it was the 4th race and not the last race, because I don't think I could have waited that long. she's just a really hard knocking filly. And I was proud of her that day, and it was funny because we got back to the barn after the races, and everybody's excited, and she's just eating hay, you know, drinking her water. Like, she, at the time, that made her 5 for 8, so it was old hat to her. Like, you know, what are you guys so excited about? it worked out perfect, and kind of, you know, I've got some eyes on me from that, and, I did an interview with Caleb Keller before the race. And then afterwards, he's like, well, we have to do one now. And I've been friends with Caleb since before he worked for TVG. So to do my interview with him was, you know, that was great too. So
yeah, it's really cool. He's a really nice guy. My son works for TVG. He's a cameraman for TVG. And I've gotten to meet Caleb and talk to him a little bit. And he's really cool. You know, you mentioned all the trainers you work for: Wesley Ward, Nick Zito, Larry Jones, Joe Sharp, your dad, Kelly Von Hemel. It's a pretty impressive litany of trainers. When Chuck Simon was on this program, he said, when I went to work for Alan Jerkins, I thought I knew a lot about horses. After 3 days, I found out I knew nothing. Did you have one of those moments?
Yeah, you know, I think it's a little bit of everything. Because when I worked for Nick, it was so much of the management of the people and the horses, because he was just so big at the time, and it was when he had Dialed In, he had Jackson Bend, you know, so we had so much going on, so many eyes on us, that it was more just managing the people. And then when I went to work for Joe, I think that kind of cemented my whole, I still have some things I can learn, and I can learn them here. because Joe had the size, but he also had the horsemanship. And he could really, you know, he could tell you a lot, and he remembered everything. And he just kind of, right there, like, I learned a lot from my dad. I learned a lot from Larry. You know, I learned a lot from, you know, everybody before Joe. But when I got to Joe, like, I learned how to manage it all, the horsemanship and the, you know, the business side of it, because he was good at both. And, but that was kind of, you know, my, that was when I kind of started putting it all together.
Was he inspirational too? Because he's was just starting out. I mean, I still consider him, I guess he's been on his own for what, a couple of years now, maybe, but
yeah, I think it's about 4 years now, but yeah. I mean,
is it that long? Boy, time flies. That's crazy.
I think so. Yeah, yeah. Time does fly. But I think, you know, just being with somebody young who kind of knew that I wanted to do it. And I think he appreciated, you know, that it wasn't just another job. Cause there, you know, there are people out there that they love horse racing, but they love having their own life separate from it. And, you know, they don't want to get to the next level and be a trainer, and that's great. That's fine. You know, you got to have people that want to just be an assistant and do that and everything. But he, you know, he knew that I wanted to do more. And so, you know, we would talk and we would have some pretty solid discussions about the horses. And, you know, he kind of would leave me to my own devices sometimes. And I would look for claims for him and dig through, you know, the racing form. And, you know, it always worked out. You know, it worked out great working for Joe for the time that I was there. And, you know, he kind of also drove home the sometimes you have to make sacrifices in your life to make the business work. And, you know, that went a long way for me as well.
No, that's good. Sounds like a real inspirational guy. You also spent a lot of time working for Wesley Ward. Talk about that experience.
Yeah, working for Wesley, I mean, it was a different experience. He's a great guy. He would do anything for you. And but working around all those young horses, you know, like you kind of learn how to manage them so that you don't run into the issues that a lot of people run into if they only have 3 or 4 babies. I mean, you had, I think when I first started, we had, I think, 3 barns at Keeneland that summer before I left for Saratoga. And I think we had something like 60 babies. And so you're, you know, watching them develop, learning, you know, the way he does things to get them to be those early babies that can win in April. I mean, every year he wins, what, 4, 5, 6 baby races at Keeneland. And just learning how to manage those, you know, issues that you'll run into as well as, like, how to get them ready that early. It was just the experience I had never had. Because, you know, growing up around my dad and, you know, Larry, you know, they're a little more conservative on the side of, you know, take the time and, you know, bring him along, however. And then, you know, when I worked for Joe, he didn't have, I mean, we had some babies and young horses, but we had a lot of horses that he had claimed. So getting to see horses develop from, you know, coming on the track and running in April to, you know, running, you know, I was around Lady Aurelia, who, you know, would go on to win at 2 and at 3 in Ascot, which is, you know, to develop that from being to, you know, that whole year. It was a cool thing to be around and see that development happen.
Yeah, it's amazing. You know, you think about training horses in general, and you always, you know, think about what you can do for each particular horse and how much they are all individuals. But then you have a guy like Wesley who concentrates on the 2-year-olds, and there's other trainers too. And they get those horses fired up at an early age, and it's a little bit different philosophy. And it can go one way or the other. We interviewed Hall of Fame trainer Richard Mandela one afternoon prior to the Breeders' Cup at Keeneland. And I asked him why he didn't win with very many first-time starters anymore, because when he first started, he was an absolute phenomenon with first-time starters. And he said, because I don't need to. When I was starting out, I needed to get noticed, so I fired with everyone. Now I can take my time if I want. Yeah, you can do anything you want. Now you're a Hall of Fame trainer, dude. Right. Nobody's going to argue with you, right? So, yeah. Where do you fall in the philosophy of all of that? What do you think about when somebody sends you a horse and you've got to make those decisions?
You know, a lot of it is just I try to make them all count. I'm not right now, you know, given a race it's hard to do in this day and age because everybody kind of wants they want instant results. So you have to keep that in mind. You know, I had a filly that, filly mostly awesome that I got in August, from Market Street Stable. And she's a food peg filly, and she's a food peg filly. You know, she had her mind made up on what she was going to do, and she was pretty, you know, on edge all the time. So I told them, you know, they wanted to run her at Keeneland. She had been kicked out for 30 days, and I said, well, there's a race at the end of the meet. We'll point her to that. And, you know, that was kind of the decision. And I kind of just dialed her back and tried to rein her in as much as I could. And just to see her development from when I got her in August to where she is now, you know, first time I ran her, she ran fifth, only got beat three lengths at Keeneland. And that was, I think that was her best number she had ever run in her life. And, you know, they were happy. She made the lead. She was just a little short. It was going mile 16. So, you know, it was kind of understandable. And then I ran her next time out at Churchill. And she ran fourth, beating two lengths. And just, she's really coming along. She is so much more mature now than she was when I got her that, you know, I'm proud of her. They're proud of her. And to me, just watching that development happen is a great thing because she needed that. And they were understanding of that from day one. Now, when I claim a horse, you know, I'm like, all right, let's get this thing ready to run and be on top of our game next time out. And, you know, Cypher and Sue, I claimed her for 15 at Churchill. And I'm not going to lie, the people that I claimed it for, they, you know, they trusted me to claim her. But they told me that, like, well, we didn't really see it. And a couple of my friends were like, well, you know, we didn't see it either. And, you know, she came in and she ran second, gets me the neck 20-1 for 30 down here. And so, you know, I was extremely happy with her. But she was so young, and I claimed her off of a conservative trainer. And I knew that she probably hadn't been tested yet. And she was still running. She ran two good races at Keeneland and Churchill. You know, they were kind of sneaky good races, I guess you would call them. She broke terrible in debut, and she galloped out in front of the field. But she got beat 10 lengths. And then the time after that was first time going long. And she just kind of flattened out at the eighth pole. And that's the day that I took her. And I knew she was going to be more of a grinder. And so David Cohen, he worked her down here. And I told him, I said, you know, she's a grinder. You're going to have to stay after. And he came back and he's like, yeah, he's like, well, you're not wrong about how to ride her. And then when he rode her in the race, you know, he followed the eventual winner through the hole. But at the top of the lane, she had six lengths to make up. And she, you know, she gets me the neck. So I was tickled to death with it, and the owners were too. And, you know, so it's kind of just a mix. It just depends on the horse. If the horse is ready to do it, then you think, you know, you crank and you fire and you're ready to go. But if they need that time to develop, then you have to dial back and say, okay, you're not going to win for a few races. You're going to learn a few things. And, you know, that's kind of where, you know, you have to bring your patience into play. And if you convey that message to your owners prior to it, then, you know, they're usually pretty understanding. But if you go out there and you just run the horse and it runs a beaten six, you know, or a closing six, rather, and they're like, well, you know, that's, you know, we were expecting something more. And then you tell them after the fact, well, you know, you thought it was a good race. They may not be as understanding. So it's all about, you know, each individual horse learning, you know, what they need and then going from there.
In case you tuned in late, this is Jude Feld, and I'm visiting with trainer Jason Barkley on Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. You know, it is nice if the owners aren't expecting too much and the horse exceeds the expectations, it's almost like a win. But if it's the other way around, then it's a horrible loss. So it is good to temper those expectations, let people know what's going on. I totally agree with you, and I think that's something that will really serve you well in your career. With all the guys that you've worked for that are, you know, household names, really, is there any specific things that you've incorporated into your program from a specific trainer?
I'd have to say, like, with my babies, so I've acquired a few babies with Franklin. I have Equine, like I said earlier, and then I've got a couple more babies that my dad currently has, so he's kind of prepping to the point until I get them we'll start breeding them. It's a lot of, I took from Wesley, how important the gate work is. And like his babies fire out of there, and when they make the lead, they're tough to pass. And so just the way that he goes about training to get them ready and fire out of the gate, I've definitely brought that in to, you know, my side of things. And then you know, from Joe, just trusting yourself on your claims, and, you know, knowing that you know what you're doing, and, you know, you don't always have to, everybody doesn't have to understand why you're doing what you're doing. They just got to trust you, and you got to trust yourself. Because in this business, like, if you're not confident in yourself and your own decisions, nobody else is going to trust you. Because, I mean, at the end of the day, your business is your name plus racing stable for the most part. So it is, it's all, you know, it's all on you. And so you have to trust yourself 100% in order to make it work and to make people, you know, trust you and believe in you. And so it's a lot of just, you know, believing in yourself and knowing that you know what you're doing. And I'd say that's kind of the biggest thing for me that I've taken from everybody, is that you don't have to explain yourself. You just have to know that you know what you're doing.
Yeah, that reminded me of when I won my first race. That's the first thought that came through my head as the horse was crossing the wire, is, you know what you're doing. Because I'd had a little issue with the owners, the horse that they claimed had a few problems, and I worked on him. I was rubbing him myself, taking care of him, doing the absolute best job I could do with the horse. And I scratched him one day out of a race. He was 6-5 on the morning line, and I scratched him because he wasn't really right that day. And I said, I can't run this horse. He's not, you know, he's not where he needs to be. And they kind of got mad at me. And, you know, but when I ran him back, he won and got claimed. And I said to myself, as he hit the wire, you know what you're doing. And it was a great boost for me. I understand where you're coming from. So you talk about claiming horses, and what do you, when you're like going through the form, you have somebody that wants to spend X number of dollars on a horse, or maybe you're looking for horses for your list. What do you look for when you're looking to claim a horse?
I like a horse that is consistently, you know, there. You know, they might not always win, but, you know, they're running second, third, and fourth. You know, they're running good races. And, you know, that for me is a lot. You know, you have to have a horse that knows how to win or how to pick up a check. Because, you know, you take too many chances, and, you know, you can't. Sometimes they are what they are. You can't develop them into any more than that. So, you know, like I claimed my first, the Stellanova, my winner. You know, she had won. I think she was 3-6 when I claimed her. So she knew how to win. It's just a lot. Starting at the form is all about their consistency. But I also watch a lot of races from all over. So I might see horses that have had a couple trouble trips, and they'll make my list. Just because I know I can, you know, if they get a clean trip, then they might be the best horse. And, you know, cause I grew up, you know, working with horses, but I was also a handicapper. Like I've you know, I've been handicapping, and I bet races since I was probably too young to bet. But, you know, it's bringing that all in as well, you know, knowing that, hey, you know, Churchill from the date of May 1st till June 1st is a speed-favoring track. This horse is a dead closer. You can claim him when they drop him in because he's probably better than that. So it's just mainly I look for consistent horses, but, you know, if I see something that kind of sticks out to me from a like maybe a low-percentage trainer who just runs this horse every chance that he can, you know, for example, Stranglehold, I claimed him off a guy in Hawthorne who the horse had run 12 times since June, and I claimed him in December. So he was just a tired horse at that point. I gave him 5 weeks. He came down here, and he ran a big third. And, you know, hopefully he can, and he came out there, it's great, and, you know, find the spot and run him back, and he should be, you know, he'd be one of the favorites and have a good chance in that spot. So it's a lot, you know, I'll grind through the form, you know, I'll sit there and look at it for, you know, a day, and then I'll let it sit, and then I'll go back and look at it again. Like, all right, do I really like this horse or not? And then, you know, I dive into the replays and see, you know, how they move and go from there. And, you know, like I said, I use the Thoroughgraphs a lot as well, because you can find races that are better than they look in the form because, you know, maybe they ran a great number that day, and, you know, you can build off of that.
Yeah, find something that'll make them improve, like equipment change, right, or maybe a different surface or whatever. And I know some guys look for spots in a condition book too, because they'll know there's a race on the horizon for a particular horse and claim them and then, you know, run them back in that race, like a kind of a quick claim kind of a deal. So
absolutely. And like down here, you can claim with like the, cause there are so many non-winners of the year conditions that are from a certain date. And if a horse fits that condition, you can claim them, wheel them right back, and you're sitting in a great spot.
Yeah, absolutely, and make some quick money in the process. What about young horses? You mentioned Franklin Avenue Equine Advisors, your partnership and your syndication group. Do you hit the sales much? Would you like to hit them more? What's your philosophy there?
Yeah, you know, we bought the one filly out of the Keeneland September sale, and you know, we looked at a bunch of horses, you know, through that whole process, and you know, we found this filly that, you know, I kind of fell in love with when I saw her, and you know, we got lucky and got her, and we'd like to be a little more active. We went back, we were at Fasig in October, and we bought an Arch filly as well that we have, and so we have the two fillies right now. We're definitely kind of, we are geared towards buying fillies. I think they have a tendency to be a little more precocious and a little more mature a little earlier. So, you know, that's kind of where, you know, we've taken it. You know, Brian DiDonato, he's kind of the leading body in this. I'm just kind of the eye that goes and looks at all the horses. And, you know, I dig through the catalog as well, but, you know, he's kind of the main pedigree guy. He dives in. We actually had just sold a filly in January at Keeneland that we claimed for $7,500. We wheeled her in the January sale, and she sold for $30 as a broodmare prospect. So, you know, we're kind of doing a little bit of that kind of pinhook, the mares. We're trying to get some money together to do another similar venture, maybe get two or three to claim and sell in November of next year. But we're kicking around the idea of going to OBS in March and April, and hopefully, you know, we can get, maybe we'll find something down there. I don't love the two-year-old training sales personally, because you get horses that are a little more inflated, and they work as fast as they go that day is probably the fastest they're ever going to go. And when you start to deal with that, you can run into some issues because they are still so young and you don't know what it took to get them to that spot. So, you know, we're kind of more on the yearling, buy the yearling, get my hands on them as early as I can and go from there. But, Brian, he does a great job, and, you know, he's very good at the communication side of things. And, you know, we send out updates all the time on those horses. And he, he's very supportive in everything that, you know, I have going on. And even, like, if somebody sends me a horse, hey, you know, we're trying to sell this horse, you got any interest, I'll shoot it over to Brian and say, you know, what do you think about the pedigree? You know, he's he handicaps for Betfair, I believe it is. So, you know, he's a big handicapper, big pedigree guy. So he kind of brings it all in as well. So he and I kind of, we work well together. He's a big paper guy. Like, you know, what do they look like on paper? And I'm a big physical guy. Like, how do they look as an animal? So we kind of put it all together, and it works pretty well for us.
That's great. It's great to have a fantastic partner when you go into business. I can't believe how fast this show went.
Yeah, this is a quick hour.
It was unbelievable. I mean, this hour just flew by. It was crazy. I really appreciate you taking the time to spend with us, I wish you all the best going forward and continue your striving for the number one spot in the nation. I think you've got a great future ahead of you.
Well, I appreciate it, and thanks for having me on. It was great.
Well, that was quick. Thanks to Jeff Barkley for taking the time to hang out with us this evening. A special thank you to Lee Della Pina, the best producer in all of horse racing, for keeping us in line and on time. I want to remind everyone to tune into the Equine Forum, the show that launched the network, this and every Saturday morning, 8 a.m. Eastern Time on Sirius 219, XM 206, and streaming live on our website, horseracingradio.net. This is Jude Feld from our Jimmy John's of Lexington, Kentucky studios. Good night, everybody.